You may know you're listening to this show along the Marketing Podcast Network, but did you know there are other great shows on MPN to help your business? Christy Hyler hosts a fantastic podcast called Own It. Christy, tell us more about the show.
Own It is all about celebrating women and non-binary advertising agency owners. We talk about buying out of the Boys Club of Advertising because less than 1% of ad agencies are owned by women.
And where can people subscribe?
You can find the podcast at untilyouownit.com. We're also on the Marketing Podcast Network at marketingpodcast.net. And of course, you can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
You heard her. Go subscribe.
Are you going to be in Austin for South by Southwest? If so, don't miss the On Brand podcast live on the podcast stage. We'll have a special episode featuring Heather Whaling and other guests talking about how your brand can take a stand. Join us on Saturday, March 11th from 11 to noon at the JW Marriott in Austin. See you at South by Southwest.
Welcome to On Brand, a podcast for brand builders by brand builders. Here's your host, Nick Westergaard of Brand Driven Digital.
Hey, brand builders, have we got a show for you? This week's guest is Doug Kessler. Doug is co-founder and creative director of Velocity Partners, the London-based B2B content marketing agency and Content Marketing Institute Agency of the Year.
Doug, woohoo!
Sorry. You are to hold your woohoos, sir.
Sorry.
Doug has written a lot about content marketing, including the B2B Content Strategy Checklist, Insane Honesty in Content Marketing, and Crap, Why the Biggest Threat to Content Marketing is Content Marketing. Doug, full of woohoos from around the world, welcome to On Brand.
Thank you very much. I spoiled my own intro.
You did, but I approve of that.
You rolled with it.
I did.
A pro.
Yeah, I could have gotten real angsty and said, "Now wait, I'm going
do
to
do it again."
Right. Would have been awkward for all parties involved.
I would have deserved it. So thank you for your graciousness.
Well, thank you for joining us here. And I have to say, sure, as I was reading through everything with your London home base, you have much to be envied, Doug Kessler. But I am looking at this and seeing that you have written something called Crap : And I'm like, what a great place to get to first. You've written Crap : Why the Biggest Threat to Content Marketing is Content Marketing.
I hadn't noticed that colon until you pointed it out.
Well, and colon jokes aside, which is about the only way you can go with the colon joke, Crap is a great title for something. But I also like, and why don't we just start careening through that, the biggest threat to content marketing is content marketing. And it's funny because you were top of mind this week because I teach also at the University of Iowa, and I was talking about content. I was showing the story of content featuring you, Doug Kessler, and many others.
Oh, that's like the film. I love that. That's
it
cool.
It is. It does make me feel like a high school social studies teacher, though, because I put the film strip on. But it's right. It's at least a very high-quality Content Marketing Institute film strip.
Film strips. I haven't heard that concept in years. I'm so glad you brought up film strips. There used to be, remember the beeps? You're supposed to, there was beep, a beep in the beep, audio track beep, that you could advance them. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and it was like a privilege that the teacher would get to wheel that card in with the reel-to-reel on
film
it.
Film strips. God, it would be great to collect those now. Film strips. I bet a good 60% of the audience doesn't even know what we're talking about when
we say. I know. We'll skip ahead a few. I don't know what they're.
Yeah.
These were before we had Snapchat stories.
Google it. Yeah, they were like what were those viewers on the stereo viewer things?
Stereoscope. Yeah.
For those, yeah.
Well, as we talk about old school content, I do love in talking about content this week because that's always where I leave that conversation, where I get students, you know, kind of excited about the vast world of content, but kind of the other shoe dropping is when we all get into the content business, it has the potential to weaken all of our content, which I would assume is the point of Crap.
You assume what you haven't read, but teasing you. Yeah, absolutely. It is the kind of the depressing thing, because in the early days, like if you just did content marketing, it was a surprising thing in any market. It's like, wow, a prospect would be like, here's a vendor giving me some advice on how to do my job for free. What a cool thing to do. I like them a lot more. I think more of them. What a neat thing. It was an advantage just to do it. And that's gone. Like it ain't an advantage anymore when everyone does it. So clearly it still has tons of benefits. I don't think it's going anywhere. It makes too much sense to go anywhere. But it's not instant advantage now. Now the bar's up and you've got to be better than anyone else. Your content has to be really, really good. And you know, in crap, we talk about building a content brand. Which I think is a really important effort to work in parallel with building your brand. You need to build a content brand.
So what is could you define those two? Because I think people get, okay, I have to make content and I have to build my brand. What is this content brand of which you speak?
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, the core brand is, you know, the whole company and the product is like, I always think of a brand as a promise, you know, or a set of promises. And you break that and you hurt the brand, you uphold it, you keep the brand and the sum of all the experiences. A content brand is saying, if it's from this company, it's going to be worth my time. I mean, or that's the effect of a strong, powerful content brand. A weak one is the opposite, you know, is like, if it's from them, I'm not going to bother. Somewhere in between is where most brands lie, where their content brands are kind of like, yeah, some of their pieces are good, some not so good. For me, you want a strong – if you have a strong content brand, you know, people think, wow, if they produced it, it's going to be smart. It's going to be, you know, fun to read. It's going to be useful. If they think that about you already, I mean, it's like having a tailwind and a plane. You know, it's like everything's easier. Everything you try to do, and if you don't have one, if you have a bad content brand, it's a headwind. You're just fighting to get noticed. You've done all that work to get something in front of someone and they think, it's from them. I don't need to read it. So, I mean, a content brand is a hugely important thing. And every piece you put out either builds or detracts it. There's not really a lot of neutral space in this. You know, you're either building and strengthening your content brand, or you're weakening it with kind of half-assed stuff or stuff that is mediocre.
I love that point too, because I think that it's missed a lot, because you know, when we do get into the we gotta all crank the content up to 11 and we are turning out reference to your well-titled work, crap. When we put that out, we do think that we're checking the box. I think, like you laid out there, that you have the potential to help or hurt. And I think sometimes we think, if I just check the box, even if it's not helping as well as I could, it's still going to do something good. And I to your point, I don't think that's always the case.
Absolutely. And that, you know, I think in the early days it may have been the case. Look, do something credible that's helping your audience. And hey, plus, you got a plus. But I think you're right. I think now the bar is higher. And I always think, like, if you're thinking, will this get downloaded and read and that kind of thing, that's a target. But will it make them come back for more? You know, if that's the target, would people release as much as they're releasing now? You know, if you really think, will this thing, they've given me their time, their attention, will it reward that so much that they come back for more? And that's a much higher bar. It's a longer term play, and that's why brand is a longer term thing for a content brand. So I don't think people are thinking that much about it. I think you're right. I think it's like, yeah, it's an infographic. Look, it's just like all the other, you know, it ticks all the boxes. So get it out there. I just think the bar is higher now, and that actually not only have you sent out a neutral thing, you've sent out a negative thing.
Yeah, it's taking up space that we don't have. In thinking about this, it almost seems like in some cases, for some brands, it might even be about creating less content, if that's a path to creating better content. Is that a fair read?
I do think so. I know that, you know, there's lots of debate about quantity, quality, and I always think, look, do as much as you possibly can above a certain quality threshold, but that's a high threshold. And often I really think it's a good thing. Think about, you know, you've got a program coming up, you've got 10 pieces planned. If you collapse 10 into one or even 5 into one, say I'm going to spend the same amount of time, energy, budget of for the next 5 pieces on one piece. Think about what you would and could do, you know? I just think it's freeing to say, we're going to over-service it. We're going to make this great, not just 5 good or 1 great. I actually think 1 great gives you better return in general than 5 good. I mean, there might be some cases to be made for, no, we need to have this cadence, and in itself will be worth it. But yeah, I think if the route to better is less than two less, do fewer pieces.
Well, and your point about 1 great versus 5 good, I think if you've got 8 not so good and you, to take anything to great, you need to pare back some of the others. I think that finding that path to great is better, even if it comes at that sacrifice there.
We've seen that in our own content program for Velocity, but also for clients. You know, a home run piece has disproportionate impact, and it raises all the other boats. You know, it makes a big impact on your content brand. So, I mean, that crap piece in itself is over 3 million views for us. It's like a really, for B2B, that's like a big, for me, that's close to viral for B2B. But, and its impact on our business was way bigger than, you know, 5 of our ones that kind of cluster around our average performance, for sure. No doubt about it.
So to someone out there listening that perked up at that idea, that impact, that return, and thinks, I would love to make some of this home run content of which Doug speaks about, is there an easy checklist or at least certainly setting yourself up for doing something, for creating something that's closer to the great versus the good?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I don't think easy checklist or formula, but there are some principles. Like, you know, the first one is aim for it. Like, honestly, that's number one. Are you in that game? Are you in the home run game? If you're not, you're not going to get one. I mean, you may stumble into one. You just might. But chances are no. And so the very, very first thing is, how high are you aiming? You know, and if you really are aiming high, then you have to hold yourself honestly. Like, there has to be kind of a candid culture that says, is this good enough? Is this home run potential? Have we worked hard enough? Do we understand the audience well enough? Is there fresh space in the market for this? You know, it's about hard work and respecting the audience and some basic integrity and honesty with yourself and your team to say, did we aim high enough and did we hit it? And if not, let's hold off until we do. Let's redo this. So that's almost, I guess it's a little bit, feels like a glib answer. But the funny thing is how few people even aim for great. They don't even aim for home run. And so, you know, the chances of getting it just dramatically reduce.
Well, I think that's a really good point, because at first you said that, I'm like, what does he mean? But then as I started thinking about it, you've got all of this kind of also ran content out there, which is, you know, doesn't just appear. Most know that, that blog post, that list, that ebook exists, you know, 20 different ways. This was just our badged over version of it.
And I think we
know that.
Yeah, we all know. And, you know, you hold a mirror up. And I'm not saying like everything we do is absolute home run stuff. Like, you know, there are definitely blog posts where you just want to capture this idea as well as you can, get it out there, share it with people. And that's a worthy thing. I don't want to take away from that. Like, I think a home run is part of a program. It's not that you only do them. I mean, you know, and also, you know, if you only aim for home runs, you do a lot of striking out too, like keeping the baseball metaphor. Babe Ruth struck out more than anybody. So I do think it is a balance. And not to say that the other stuff is dramatically lower, but you know, you've got some hardworking, you're still working really hard to do the job at hand, this post or this book, you know. But there are a few where you reserve some bandwidth to say, can we blow people away?
Well, and you, in thinking about all of this and thinking about being the Content Marketing Institute Agency of the Year, you know, especially there's That's I didn't realize that was it's a sound that you're contractually bound to make. Yeah. It goes with the award. With the
Absolutely. I use the logo. I use the Wahoo. You have to pay for the Wahoo.
Right.
You don't just use the Wahoo.
If you're going to license all of that,
every time anyone says that, I say Wahoo. It's just instant reaction. I'm still quite pleased.
But but on the B2B side of that too, which you've mentioned a couple of times, but I think there's a common thinking that all of this gets harder. Is that the case? Is it harder or is it different?
Harder to kind of hit a home run in B2B than B2C, is that? Yeah. I think it's probably just different. I mean, there is some real hard work to do in B2B. You know, there is the hard work of, you know, understanding the target audience and understanding sometimes the product itself. Like, we work in tech markets. Those aren't always easy. It can take quite a while just to get to the starting point of what does this thing really do for people. So there's that. But I wouldn't want to downplay what a beer brand or a perfume has to do. Sometimes I look at perfume and think, really? I mean, really? Is that all you had to do? Give it to Johnny Depp and call it Sauvage? I don't know. It doesn't look like hard work to me, but I'm sure a lot of hard work goes into it. So I think it's different. And the whole game is certainly different. Long purchase cycles, buying teams instead of single impulse buys. So there's plenty that's different. I'm not sure it's that much harder. In some ways, it might be easier because the conventions of B2B markets are deadening. Like most B2B marketing is quite middle of the road. So you might say it's easier for us to leap out because, you know, we're competing with some boring junk out there. So, you know, I think every brand has that advantage. So in some ways, B2B ought to be easier.
Well, I think that's a really good point too, because your crap quotient is potentially higher, which I would think would leave it a little more ripe for a home run condition.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. I mean, one thing that happened since writing crap is I did expect there to be utter dreck out there, and of course there is. But what really has happened since publishing crap is there's a lot more mediocrity. It isn't out and out crap. Marketers are smart people. They learn fast. They get it. You know, they're not, you know, it's rare that you really put out something you think is a howlingly bad. But mediocrity is the real threat today, which is, you know, as you said, tick box stuff. This is good enough. This looks a lot like the other stuff in the market and other markets. So boom, there it is. It's that mediocre bar, that horrible. And there's this gravity towards the middle of the bell curve, that gravity towards the mediocre that is so really hard to resist. So, you know, if it might be easier to jump out of a market in B2B, but there's also this incredible gravity within a company to drag you back to the mean, you know. So we have to kind of try to earn a little bit of space in your culture to say, let's break out of this market instead of just being one of the people in it. If you can do that internally, you probably have a better shot at it out there.
Well, and I think that's a huge point too, when you were saying aim for it earlier, and you know, it as I thought about it made more sense, but it's not like it's hard because the opposite of aim for it is to not aim for it. But I think it's that gravity that you're talking about, because I don't think anybody sets out for the other. The other just gravity is a great metaphor for it, because you just kind of get pulled into it, and you end up kind of without that foresight of aiming for it. It's easy to end up, how the hell did we get down here? And, you know,
absolutely. That is so, it's so true. And it's like, I think part of the job is, can we expose the group dynamics in our company or culture that have led to this kind of, you know, gravity thing prevailing? And what can we do? Can we actually expose those and talk about it with people and say, there's something going on here that we need to break before we can do great work, and we need to admit that this is happening, and then we need to, you know, pay attention to some things that most businesses don't pause to pay attention to, like culture and relations between people, group dynamics, all this huggy California stuff that a lot of people never bother to pause and think about. But what's so funny is that those things make or break So, you know, they make success or failure. They, you know, you get it right. You get a great group dynamic, a great culture, and boom, these things can fly, you know. And so I think it's really worth paying attention to those soft things. And it's quite a hard, you know, in both senses thing to do to pay attention to them. But I know that there's, you know, people are embarrassed by thinking of those things. But I think you really trail back a lot of mediocre work and just how do such smart people make such so-so stuff. And it generally is stuff like that. It's about culture and group dynamics and, you know, that kind of thing.
Well, I think the internal groups, but I think when you were initially talking about gravity, you also talked about the industry. And I think that's another, again, something you don't set out to do, but, oh, what's the pack doing? And
absolutely,
we're all making the, you know, we're all doing a lot of lead gen. We've all got this same kind of webinar about this stuff, and it's kind of, it ends up slowly infecting what we're doing, how we're doing it, and you end up kind of creating a Me Too industry where you're all kind of saying the same things.
That's totally true. I think there's this huge kind of almost invisible consensus that here in the insurance market, we will talk this way about insurance. And, you know, I just think a marketer's job, like everyone when they're marketed to, they raise the barriers and they try to think, okay, this is marketing, I'm going to filter it. The only way to get people to lower that is surprise them a little bit, to send something their way that doesn't look and smell and feel like marketing. And so it's our job in any market to look at the conventions in our own market. How does everyone talk? Well, let's not. What would happen? And this can be an internal experiment in a company. You don't have to go right to market with this, but find out what it would feel like to play against the conventions of a market. And it can be really liberating and lead to some super powerful stuff. And I mean, sometimes it comes down to, well, who are you going to steal from? Are you going to steal from the other mediocre stuff out there? Or are you going to steal from great work, you know? And who wouldn't want to steal from great work, you know? The aim for that.
Well, I think so. I love the idea of consensus, too, because it kind of drives home the fact that nobody really sets out to, hey, let's all meet and agree to all sound the same. But it does end up happening, and I think there's... Yeah. I think it's oddly comforting. I mean, nobody wants to do this, but I think it makes us feel like we're kind of in the bell curve. We're at least producing that.
It's really interesting. You're right. It is that. It's a comfort zone thing. I mean, if you give like a – you have students, right? So if you tell them, write me an ad, they go into ad mode. You know, they're writing stuff that looks like ads. You tell a kid, a five-year-old, write me an ad for that, you know, that hat, and you'll see an ad that looks like an ad. You know, this is, I guess, how humans do it. But, you know, we're talking about default settings. And I think a marketer is one of our primary jobs is to expose those default settings, flick the switches to other settings, see what happens. I think usually some really great things happen, and that then you can take those to market. But you're right. It's just it's a comfort zone thing. And especially when you're reporting to stakeholders internally, sometimes you really have to pave the way with them and say, if you just drop the new thing on their lap, they're like, that doesn't look like marketing. Get that out of here. It's like, exactly. That's the point. But if you pave the way a little bit and say, look, we think the market's got this deadening convention. We've fallen into it. Here are some things we've noticed. Everyone says this, this, and that. What if we didn't? Everyone does this. What if we didn't? And then you kind of like pave that strategy. So it looks considered, strategic, not just some kind of creative, you know, whim. You get a little bit more runway.
Yeah, I'd say that's kind of that would be the other pendulum swing too, would be there's the stuff that is the convention of the industry. And then unless you have it grounded in some sort of strategy that makes sense, you have something that could just be the whim of a perfume ad.
Yeah. And you do get that too. You get people who are so, you know, they're right and they want to stand out, but they go to the instant, like, you know, at Ogilvy in the 80s, we used to call it the gorilla in a jockstrap. You know, you can always get attention. Just, you know, put a gorilla in a jockstrap. And it's, you can see the ones that are doing that. They're just kind of shouting and being juvenile or something for attention. And there's no there underneath it. And that doesn't work either. That's kind of embarrassing. So I think if you can wed it to strategy, then you've got a winner. You know, you get the best of both.
Well, I love that of wedding it with strategy too, because I think sometimes you say strategy and people think dusty conventional stuff that we're trying to get away from. But I think that that home run work is usually one of the unsexy reasons it's a home run results-wise is because it does something very specific, communicates something very specific that was the organizational outcome that you were aiming for.
Yeah, that specific thing is a really good point because I think what kills a lot of content too, or one of the deadening factors, is it's trying to do too much. And we kind of evangelize this idea of a content mix where, I know we didn't invent this, but the idea that, look, different pieces will do different things. You'll have heart pieces and head pieces and explainers and, you know, and then some why we do what we do pieces. And if you can know that you've got this mix and then free any given piece from trying to do it all, it can do its one thing really, really well. I mean, the crap piece was trying to do one thing, express a certain fear that as content marketing went mainstream, it was going to change. A very simple one thing. It happened to be timely and got lucky. But I think if we were trying to then tell the whole story of content marketing and, you know, benefits and blah, 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 it would have fallen under its own weight. And I think that there's always that temptation too, that people think, whoa, we're paying for an ebook here. We got to cram it with our whole story. So I think that specificity you brought up, I think, is a really big point, the focus.
Well, and that and kind of sorting out so that not everything is charged with doing everything too.
Yeah. And one of the things, I mean, what I love is content that kind of celebrates the why, that Simon Sinek stuff about why do you do what you do? And content that only does that, doesn't even try to connect it beyond. I think it's super powerful, but it's a really hard thing for us to get clients to do and for, you know, a lot of people in companies to get comfortable with it. Just celebrate a belief. You've got a belief. Go ahead and celebrate that and other people who share the belief. That alone is actually, you're speaking to the gut, you know, you're actually doing something for your brand that's really, really important that isn't particularly rational. But it's a hard one to sell in, but we all know we respond to these things.
Well, and it's usually a very simple thing strategically that you're aiming for, and sometimes it can look too simple. So like you said, in selling that internally, sometimes it feels like it can seem that's all we're doing. You know,
I
want to do more than that. Don't we want to, you know, drive funnel traffic? And
exactly. Especially, I know there are these kind of hard-bitten sales guys in every company. And the thing that I despair about most is that the things we're talking about come off as soft and what they do is hard. There's like benefits, features, benefits, that'll, you know, don't forget we're here to make money. Of course we are. I think this way is a way better route to way more money. It's the hardest nose thing you'll ever do is to appreciate the fact that decision making is made in a certain way and that it involves the gut more than the head. And that, you know, I hate when I'm in a meeting and positioned as the snowflake in the corner trying to get someone to dance around and celebrate their beliefs in an interpretive dance, you know, when they want to shove benefits down people's faces and they think they're the harder working person for the revenue. And it's like, actually, the snowflakey stuff is the route to revenue or we wouldn't be talking about it. That dichotomy of that whole conversation is always depressing to me.
It is. It is an interesting push and pull, and it kind of makes me think of you talking about head pieces and heart pieces. And I think that you need both in the mix too. I mean, I think if you're the hard hitting sales all the time, then it's just going to come across as a communications jackhammer. And in the end, there's not going to be any there. There's not going to be that why, that deep belief about why someone cares. And that's what moves people. And more importantly, like you said, over time, it's those beliefs where loyalty is built and where it lies.
Absolutely. And I think there is a delusional thing about the kind of hard-nosed salesy kind of way of doing it, which is, look, we got 10 benefits in, so people took away 10 benefits. It's like, no, you got 10 benefits in, so people took away nothing. And so you deluded yourself into thinking that you've been harder, like value for money with this communication or, you know, more tied to sales and more tied to product. But you've actually shut your audience down to zero. So I think it is frustrating. I think we all know, like, behavioral economics has shown over and over and over again that, you know, that, you know, the elephant and rider thing, the Kahneman thinking fast and slow, that, you know, your gut, the elephant in you that makes the decision, you use your mind to justify it. The rational stuff is just there to say what you've already decided. We know this. I mean, it's proven in a million ways, but we're still marketing to that brain, you know, to the rider, assuming there's no elephant, you know, and that's a frustration, I think. Yeah. But, you know, see, brands who get it are breaking through. They're doing some cool things.
Awesome. Well, Doug, as we start to wrap up, we always ask, speaking of home runs, speaking of breakthroughs, is there a brand that has made you smile recently?
Yeah, good question. Brands that made me smile. I mean, a lot of I guess too few compared to all the brands out there. But I mean, can I mention a consumer one and a B2B
sure,
one?
Sure, absolutely.
All right, so like on the consumer side, there's a company called Everlane Clothing, very simple basics. Mm-hmm. I'm wearing a shirt now. And one thing they do that made me smile was this kind of radical transparency of showing their supply chain, but also their margins. They show the cost of everything, the materials, the labor, the profit. And their profit's big. It's like 50% of the product, but they just put it out there. Here's what we're making on each shirt and that kind of thing. And that made me smile just to think, you know what? There's nothing to be ashamed of in that at all. I don't begrudge you that margin. And thank you for exposing it to me. You know that. So it really was a cool feeling. That's the B2C side. And there's some just authenticity and transparency in that. But in B2B, the GE is always doing some very cool and surprising things. And one that made me smile, it's not a very recent ad, but it popped into my head when you said smile, is that the GE Hammer ad. Do you know this one?
I don't think I do.
So it's a TV ad. Go ahead and Google it. It's so cool. It's brand stuff. So they're coming out, and they've obviously done a repositioning at the time, and this may be a year old. I don't even know how old it may be, 6 months, whatever. And they realize we're a special kind of company. We're a digital company and an industrial company smacked together into one. And so the way they got it across was a person who just got a job at GE is telling his parents, and they know the old GEO, it's an industrial company. He's telling them, actually, I'm kind of a software guy. And the dad gives him a hammer. You'll need this, a big sledgehammer. And it's just a funny, funny conversation. And it ends with like, go ahead, lift the hammer. Dad, I don't want to lift the hammer. Lift the hammer. And then there's this little after punchline of he can't lift the hammer. He can't lift it. You know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know, so there's tension between the kid who's proud of his new job and the parents with their old views of what that job is. And it just really did make me smile. It was a beautiful marriage of strategy and a fresh, fresh approach to the creative of getting across this very simple idea that we're this new kind of company. So I really like it when you see the strategy, but not in a horrible way like the, you know, like scaffolding. It's just a very natural thing. It came out beautifully.
Awesome. Well, we will link up to that and embed it in our show notes as well.
It's a good one.
Doug, where can folks go to learn more about who you are and what you do?
Well, you know, velocitypartners.com, that's our website. So we try to pack a lot in there. Obviously, stuff gets out of date. We don't always put our newest work, but, you know, our content's there. So I think that's the best expression. Thank you for asking.
Awesome. Well, we will link up to all of that in our show notes. Doug, thanks for joining us on Brand.
I enjoyed it. Can I give one more woohoo?
Do it.
Woohoo. Thanks, Nick. I really enjoyed that. Great
Thank
talk.
You. And before we go, I always like to flip the microphone around to our community. Recently, Matt Reno gave us a holler on Twitter for our episode featuring Brad Flowers, saying that tonight he was going to pour some bourbon, open the sketchbook, and chill while listening to an insightful branding podcast. That sounds amazing. Thank you, Matt, for listening. And a reminder, if you like something on this episode or another, or if you have a question you'd like one of our guests to answer, let me know on Twitter using the hashtag OnBrandPodcast, and you may just hear your thoughts right here on the show. You can find those links at branddrivendigital.com. You can subscribe to the show via iTunes and Stitcher. Speaking of iTunes, if you like what you're hearing, head over there, give us a quick rating and review, help others find the show. And remember, On Brand is brought to you by my book, Get Scrappy, Smarter Digital Marketing for Businesses Big and Small. Order now at
Great
Amazon.
Book.
Thank you. That wasn't a woohoo, but yeah. but it's okay.
Excellent book.
It's still. We'll go with great book. Order now at Amazon and check out getscrappybook.com for special offers and extras. Until next week,
I'm Nick Westergaard, and I'll see you on the internet.
This has been the On Brand Podcast, presented by Brand Driven Digital. For show notes, links, and more, go to onbrandpodcast.com. Remember, you can subscribe to the show and leave a rating and review at iTunes and Stitcher. Thanks for listening.
This podcast is heard along the Marketing Podcast Network. For more great marketing podcasts, visit marketingpodcasts.net.